You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 20th of September 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24 with me, Paul Osborne. Coming up in the programme, Spain's government acts to try to stop Catalonia's independence vote, but it triggers mass demonstrations on the streets. We'll discuss what's likely to happen next in this increasingly bitter dispute. Russia's war games are coming to an end, so what was the point and what has the West learned? As the search for survivors continues after Mexico's earthquake, we find out about the warning system that saved lives there, but still isn't in place in the United States. And later on...
There's 322 cities around the world that have World Trade Centers. And through this network, we're able to connect our export-ready companies to partner companies in other markets.
We'll find out more about Toronto's latest step into world trade. All that, plus a trip to Moscow and a look at the big stories across Asia, all in the next hour on the Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. But first, a quick look at some of the day's other top news stories. Iran's president has hit back at Donald Trump after he condemned the country's regime. Hassan Rouhani told the United Nations General Assembly that Mr. Trump was a rogue newcomer to international politics. He denied planning to violate the international deal to rein in Iran's nuclear program, a deal that was dismissed by Mr. Trump yesterday as an embarrassment. Hurricane Maria has knocked out power to the entire island of Puerto Rico, affecting 3.5 million people. Maria weakened to a Category 3 storm with winds of up to 115 miles an hour as it crossed the island. Kenya's Supreme Court has criticized the body that oversaw the country's elections after it ordered a rerun of the poll. The court said the vote in August, ostensibly won by Uhuru Kenyatta, was neither transparent or verifiable. It is the first time an African court has backed an opposition demand to annul a presidential election over alleged irregularities. And Jake LaMotta, the boxer played by Robert De Niro in the famous film Raging Bull, has died at the age of 95. A former world middleweight champion, he struggled with life outside the ring. The film was based on his own memoirs. Before filming began, De Niro spent almost a year being taught how to box by LaMotta, who once said that he was only ever hurt outside the ring. Well, hello, welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily. First, the growing political argument over Catalonia's independence vote threatens to boil over into a fully-fledged national crisis after Spain's government stepped up its efforts to stop the vote taking place. Ministries of the Catalan government have been raided, more than a dozen officials detained, and Madrid has taken control of large parts of Catalonia's finances. Well, that prompted the region's president to accuse the Spanish government of a huge power grab. Well, let's talk now to Dr. Pablo Caldera Martinez, who's a lecturer at Aston University in the UK. Thank you very much for your time this evening. There has been a vote on Catalonian independence before in 2014. Madrid didn't stop that vote happening, but is clearly determined to stop this one.
Yes, well, I think there was a slight difference in that the previous vote was sold more as a consultation. And this is supposed to be a proper referendum of Catalan independence. And as you said rightly, the Madrid government is very much trying to avoid having this vote. The reasons are obviously very clear. The central government doesn't want Catalonia to become independent. But also there is a very clear legal argument in that basically the Spanish constitution says that none of the autonomous regions can become independent. That's the reality of the matter. So, yeah, I think, yeah, we've reached something of an impasse of sorts.
Well, as you say, the legal position is clear, that the courts have ruled that this vote is illegal and therefore its result would not be binding. But we're also told that the Catalan government plans to declare independence within 48 hours of a yes vote. But by taking the actions it has, there's a chance, isn't there, that the government in Madrid has now effectively guaranteed an overwhelming yes vote by seeking to interfere in a fairly clumsy way?
That could be an argument, but to be fair, I think the government in Madrid has a responsibility, and Mariano Rajoy in particular from the Popular Party has a responsibility not only to Catalonia but for the rest of Spain, and obviously his political capital, if you wish, depends not only on what people in Catalonia think about him but in the rest of Spain. So he has to be shown to be strong on this matter. He has to show strength, he has to show authority, and at the end of the day, we just don't know what the result of a referendum would be. I agree that we could, maybe, with a high degree of certainty, there would be a pro-independence result, but that doesn't change the matter that the referendum in itself is illegal, and there's very little we can do about that. I mean, the only solution, I would say, is if Catalonia goes ahead and declares itself just independent, just like that, and that would create any number of problems and issues within Spain and beyond its borders as well.
There is a sense that this argument, which has gone on for so long now, is coming to a head, that this is arriving at a point where it is going to have to be decided one way or the other.
I don't know if... I think it's getting a little bit more, yes, the arguments and the argument and the, you know, the political rhetoric is getting stronger on both sides. My concern is that it doesn't matter because there really is no solution in my mind that I can see. There is no way that I can see that Catalonia becomes independent without reformulating the constitution. That is not to say that it is impossible. There should be a way and a mechanism in which we can have a proper legal way of reforming the constitution, amending the constitution, so that there can be a path towards independence in Catalonia. But the fact is that we don't have that. And in order to have that, we have to have a majority in the Spanish Congress, in the Spanish Parliament, which we do not have and we are unlikely to have in the foreseeable future. And basically what we're seeing here is not necessarily the culmination of an old problem, but a continuation of an issue that's been carrying on for centuries, literally. And that I wish there was a solution one way or another, but my gut feeling says we're going to be stuck in this no man's land for years and years to come.
What we have seen in response to the actions of the Spanish government is these large demonstrations against those moves, and there must be some concern that if this carries on, those demonstrations could become angrier and could become more serious.
Again, I think that could be a concern, but I still think so far the demonstrations have been quite peaceful. I don't think the government of Catalonia wants or thinks it's to their benefit at all if things get violent. I certainly think the people of Spain do not want these things to get violent. The memory of the civil war is still there, and I don't think, certainly not this generation, would ever let that happen again. And if this turns into violence, basically we're talking about civil unrest. It's very hard to think of that scenario within the European Union. It's very hard to think of that scenario without the European Union intervening very vocally and very actively. So I wish I knew what was going to happen. And this is something that I've discussed with many people and colleagues. But the reality is that we seem to be in a very finely poised situation in which it could go either way. But again, my gut feeling is that it's going to go nowhere. I don't see how it can, but we'll see.
And as you mentioned, the rest of the European Union, and there are many other countries with states, regions, areas that would like independence from or greater separation from other parts of the country. And is in much the same way as people in Madrid were watching the Scottish independence referendum with great interest a few years ago. Presumably there are other EU countries looking at what's going on in Spain with great interest.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's, you know, from France, from France to, you know, obviously people in the Basque Country. And if this was to happen in Catalonia, then the Basque Country might try something similar. The Basque Country shares territory in France as well. So that's a big problem there. There's any other number of countries around Europe. But also my feeling is this is the last thing the European Union wants and people in Brussels want. We have Brexit to deal with. We definitely don't want to see what would effectively be another European state leaving the European Union through Catalan independence. We know the European Union has repeatedly said there really shouldn't be and there couldn't be a transfer of membership from Spain to Catalonia. So Catalonia would, in effect, have to leave the European Union with, as we are seeing in the UK, all the complications that it entails, all the problems. So my gut feeling is, and my idea, and I think it's pretty clear, nobody in Europe wants to see this happen. And that leaves the Catalan government in a very isolated position as well.
I suppose in terms of what the Catalan government does next, it has been very critical of the moves by Madrid today to say that it wants to press ahead with the vote. Is it your sense that that vote is still going to happen?
My sense is that perhaps the vote will go ahead perhaps in a different way, like the vote that took place a few years ago that was sold more as a consultation, where the Spanish government is going to, you know, declare that vote invalid and without any legal relevance. That could be one solution. There is no doubt in my mind, and I think everybody would agree, that the Spanish government has dealt with this situation terribly. And that stems from the division within the Spanish government, Spain as a whole. And we're seeing the reflection of this division within Spain and within Spanish politics as well. But my sense is that both sides have backed each other into a corner, and both sides have to remain strong. We have to remember this is pretty much the legacy of Artur Mas and his political party, and the legacy of the CDC in Catalonia, the independence movement. So they have to deliver independence, or they have to be seen as delivering on independence. Their political lives depends on it. And the Partido Popular in the center government, their survival pretty much depends as well on Catalonia not becoming an independent region, an independent country. So I think more than anything, the real interplay and the real interesting issues will happen in the Spanish central government and the dynamics that take place within national politics in Spain, with the emergence of a very pro-independence or pro-referendum left-wing politics of Podemos, Izquierda Unida, and a coalition. They've positioned themselves very much in favor of the referendum, and they're very, very critical of the actions of the Spanish government. So my sense is that the real game will be at national level, national politics, and that's the real thing that can change. Nothing much can change in Catalonia, or as long as the PP is in power, we're going to be in this sort of impasse, in my view.
Pablo Calderón Martínez from Aston University here in the UK, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Now, Russia's giant Zapad military exercise is coming to a close. Just how giant it is depends rather on who you ask. Moscow insists that fewer than 13,000 troops are involved. NATO thinks as many as 100,000 have taken part. And they are simulating a NATO-backed separatist revolt in Belarus. And the Western Alliance's top general has described the exercises as worrisome. Well, for more on this, I'm joined by Ottilia Dand, who's a political risk analyst and is senior vice president at Atenea Intelligence. First of all, the Kremlin has said all the way through this that Western concerns about Zapad were being overblown. Meanwhile, NATO's Supreme Allied Commander described elements of the exercises as, in his words, looking like a rehearsal of an attack. Which of them do you think is nearer to the truth?
Well, In any case, in the context we have had in relations between NATO and Russia in the past 3 years, any kind of exercise that prepares Russian military for a conflict with a NATO country is going to look menacing to from a NATO country's point of view or from the NATO military's point of view. In fact, the scenario that that Russia and Belarus chose for this particular exercise was less menacing than some of the early exercises which ended in amphibious landing on enemy territory, or in fact a nuclear attack on a capital city of an enemy country. So the choice of a separatist region within Belarus itself was actually a step down from previous exercise scenarios. But one thing has to be said, and that is that the scenario that they chose is actually really close to what is happening in Ukraine in reality.
Well, this is what I was going to say, that, you know, you say it's been scaled down from past exercises, but at its core, they are simulating a conflict between Russia and NATO powers, which is the very thing that people are particularly concerned about at the moment.
That's correct, and especially it involved the Baltic region, where in the past 3 years we have seen an increased number of Russian incursions into territorial waters and airspace. And actually we have seen several incursions over the past couple of days as well, even though it wasn't completely out of the line with what we have started to get used to as a new normal. But anything that Russia does in terms of military exercises, especially in the Baltic region, which is vulnerable and exposed, is going to make NATO countries nervous. Now, we have also seen a build-up of NATO forces in the Baltic area that Russia has been complaining about, even though it is only up to 4,000 troops. It is something that is convincing us that in the medium term, the dividing line between the NATO countries and Russia in this particular region is going to be a focus of future tension.
How important is the confusion over the numbers involved? If Russia had confirmed more than 13,000 troops, then theoretically it's supposed to then invite European monitors, though I assume the West is monitoring what's going on pretty closely anyway.
So that depends on how we look at it. Russia consistently underestimates the number of troops involved in individual exercises, and thereby it avoids the necessity or the duty to invite international observers. But also, exercises are typically cut into a sort of a kaleidoscope of individual exercises that can be counted one by one. And it's really difficult to say which individual exercise is a part of the larger group of exercises and which is not. And to count the troops that are basically just called in to sit in the barracks for 2 days to be on an alert, are they really taking part in the exercises or are they not? So any estimates of the number of forces involved that we will get will vary from one another. To me, what is more important is to see what kind of scenarios are being tested, how much force is put into these main case scenarios, what forces are involved, what new equipment is being used, and what does it mean in terms of what does it tell us in regards of Russia's own threat perception, and the possible scenarios in the event and highly unlikely event of conflict.
As you say, it's helpful to understand what Russia thinks the possible conflagration point could be. What will the NATO countries have hoped to learn from watching this?
Well, they probably will have hoped to learn what kind of tactics is Russia looking at developing and testing and developing in these particular exercises. That is to say that Russia is actually modernizing its army and trying to bring it up to the standards of the more sophisticated NATO armies. And to that effect, they are developing new tactics, new types of units, new equipment. And this is something that Russia watchers are going to pay close attention to. What we saw in this particular exercise was, for example, testing of reconnaissance balloons, drones, new armored vehicles, multiple rocket launchers, Iskander-M missiles, and a whole array of equipment that Russia would want to put on display for deterrent purposes, and we want to test in practical exercise.
Well, it hasn't all gone according to plan. Yesterday, a military helicopter mistakenly fired on a group of parked vehicles, reportedly injuring a number of people. Earlier, we spoke to the Russia analyst Stephen Diel, who said he wasn't entirely surprised.
Two helicopters were flying in. There was a military lorry under camouflage nets, and parked rather, one might say, ridiculously close to them were three ordinary civilian cars. And the helicopters did presumably what they were supposed to do and fired rockets at the target. But of course, you get collateral damage when rockets explode. And these cars were pretty badly damaged as well. But if I may put it this way, on military exercises, very often shit happens.
Ottilia, I suppose it is true, isn't it, that any large scale military exercise runs the risk of this kind of mistake?
Yes, I quite agree with that assessment. It actually wasn't the only accident that happened during these exercises. There were reports of equipment getting damaged, especially a Tu-22 aircraft which overran a runway at one of the airfields in just southwest of Moscow and was badly damaged. There were reports of units getting lost on their way to wherever they were being posted. But I suppose that in a way this is a part of any military exercise that takes place.
Ottilia Dand is a political risk analyst and also a senior vice president at Tenure Intelligence. Thank you very much. You're listening to The Daily from Monocle 24.
Visit our online shop where you can find items designed by our in-house team and collaborations with the brands that we love. Discover everything from luggage and clothes to stationery and back issues of the magazine, as well as our book series and popular travel guides. We deliver worldwide and offer high-quality customer service. And don't forget to let us know if you're a Monocle subscriber to enjoy your 10% discount. Go to monocle.com/shop and browse away. Or if you're in Tokyo, Singapore, Hong Kong, London, New York or Toronto, visit us at one of our shops and we'll take care of you personally. See you around!
Now, at least 225 people are now known to have died in yesterday's powerful earthquake in Mexico, the second to hit the country in as many weeks. Dozens of buildings collapsed in Mexico City and elsewhere, and a desperate search for survivors is continuing. But in Mexico's capital, many lives may have been saved by an early warning system, which sounded in time for some people to escape from vulnerable buildings. That's a system that was meant to be introduced for parts of the United States, but budget cuts mean it may not happen. Well, on the line now is Michael Corrin, who's a reporter for Quartz, based in the Silicon Valley. Michael, thank you for joining us. This warning system in Mexico City meant these sirens sounded for 20 or so seconds before the quake struck. How does it work?
Well, basically what they've done is they've strung sensors along the coast and along fault lines in the region. And the basic principle is that light or electricity travels faster than sound through rock or energy through rock. And so they can actually alert people faster than the quake waves arrive at the location.
Now, this is a system that they introduced in Mexico City, I think in 1991, 6 years after another earthquake that killed thousands upon thousands of people. And a similar system is supposed to be on the way for the west coast of the United States.
That's right. It's actually been in the works for quite a while. The USGS has put several tens of millions of dollars, the US Geological Survey, several tens of millions of dollars into the program, and it's due to be turned on next year. There's actually a prototype that worked in 2014 with the Napa earthquake. Of course, it all depends on the budget.
And now, what reasons have been given for the concern over the budget?
Well, there's not specifically any concerns that were issued about this program particularly. It's basically trying to slash the USGS budget across the board, and this seems to be one of the measures that has fallen under the axe. However, that was the presidential budget that was issued. Now legislators will have to decide what actually gets cut. There's been a bipartisan push against that move, and it may not actually be removed.
And is there a sense that lobbying is starting to change minds in Washington?
I think that this earthquake will focus their minds very quickly. But since July, there's been several legislators who've spoken out against the cuts. It's not the last time. There will be a $10 million budget issued this year, and then another about, I think, $30 million to build out the program, and then $16 million per year to maintain it. Of course, that's a drop in the bucket compared to the potential damage. The FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, estimates that it could be in the multiple billions of dollars the next time there's an earthquake in California.
From that, it does sound, given that there are these stats saying there's a sort of 90-something percent likelihood of a major earthquake sometime in the next 20, 30 years, you would think that just the financial argument alone would convince the government that it was worth spending the money.
You would. There is, I think, in this administration, a desire to supposedly balance the budget by 2027 and see a large cutback across the board in government agencies. The EPA, for example, was looking at a 30% budget cut. So it's in theory, these should be rational and based on priorities. I think in reality, what we're seeing is just slashing without regard necessarily to what makes sense. This may be, given the last earthquake, this may be one of the programs that survives.
People may be surprised if they're learning about this for the first time, that a system to predict earthquakes and warn people about them was introduced in Mexico City in 1991. And here we are in 2017. And not only has the United States not got that system, but it now may not have the money to switch it on.
It is quite shocking. Japan also has a system that's been put in place. I think in both cases, there was a traumatic national event, and it became a priority, and both systems were built. Some of them are outdated, particularly one in Mexico, but they do exist. And the U.S. may discover, I think, to its dismay, that another event like what recently happened in Mexico will enforce the country to build this. Hopefully that won't take place, and this will be in place within next year, and by then go up and down the coast, not just in Southern California.
And of course, America does have a very good system for alerting people to other emergencies. You have this system that can hijack broadcast signals to tell people there's a hurricane coming.
That's right, and we have this for missing and abducted children, and we actually have a tsunami alert here in San Francisco. We just need to plug it in and build out the sensor network. I think the USGS has been spread thin for a very long time, and so this is just a matter of setting priorities.
Michael Corran from Quartz, thank you very much for joining me. You're listening to Monocle 24. Well, next we go to Canada, where the World Trade Center Toronto is being launched today. It will attempt to promote international trade, but what's taken so long for the country to join the World Trade Association Club? Well, to find out more, Monocle's Henry Rees-Sheridan spoke to Janet De Silva, who is the president and CEO of the Toronto Region Board of Trade.
The World Trade Center Toronto is part of a global network. There's 322 cities around the world that have World Trade Centers. And through this network, we're able to connect our export-ready companies to partner companies in other markets.
And if I understand correctly, it is being unveiled today. Why has it taken this long for Toronto to get a branch?
Well, here's the thing. It was actually about 3 years ago yesterday that I was in an interview for the job I presently hold. And a question that was asked of me by the board was, we've got this asset called the World Trade Center Toronto. We've had it for decades. It's dormant. We don't know what to do with it. Do you have any ideas? 3 years on, let me tell you what we're doing with the World Trade Center. We've positioned it to be a trade services platform for the business community. We run a couple of key programs here that are helping export-ready companies develop export strategies and activate. So we've been really pleased with the results we've had over the 2 years of programming we've done. And today is the official coming out party, so to speak, for the World Trade Center.
So, Janet, to your mind, what are the big issues facing Canadian trade at the moment?
Well, the trade issue facing our companies is not so much our large companies. They're active globally. It's our SMEs. 99% of companies by number in Canada are SMEs. Only 4% are involved in export. In contrast to the UK, 21% of your SMEs are exporting. So if we could increase the number of our exporting SMEs from 4% to say 21%, that would generate about $255 billion in new export activity and create about 2 million new jobs at home. So there's a compelling reason to help our companies scale up and access growth markets.
So tomorrow they're going to begin to implement CETA, the trade agreement between the EU and Canada. How will this change the landscape of Canadian trade?
Well, a very interesting question, because we've just this morning released a new body of research that we've done, and it's actually mapped out the priority export markets for seven of our largest emerging and established industry sectors. Interestingly enough, many of the top countries on that list are in the EU, and not surprisingly, UK is number two in terms of potential for our businesses.
So what kind of sectors does Canada have a particular strength in, or are you focusing your attention on trying to create as well-rounded an export economy as you can?
The study itself focused on Toronto region, and in the context of North America, we've got the second largest cluster of tradable industry. So we've got breadth and depth of industry sectors. What we focused on in terms of sectors for export were some of our top performing established sectors. So it's aerospace, automotive, food and beverage, human health sciences, and our emerging tech sector, because we've got 60% of Canada's ICT is concentrated in Toronto. So it's fintech, city tech, which is smart cities type technology that's sitting in there.
You know, it's interesting to hear how much of Canada's economic activity is concentrated in Toronto. And, you know, Canada's been getting a lot of attention over the past year or so, a lot of global attention for being a kind of a bastion of liberal, progressive values that seem to be waning elsewhere in the West. But I wonder, do you think Toronto and Ontario have almost outgrown the rest of the country? Is there a risk that what's good for them may not be good for Canada?
Okay, I'd like to answer that kind of two ways. Number one, it's important for countries to have global champions. And Toronto, yes, has grown, is flourishing, is doing extremely well economically, and we are seen as the city that is Canada's global champion. That said, however, we are very actively involved in cooperation and partnerships with among the seven largest cities in Canada. The boards of trade across these large markets are working together. So some of the programming we've developed, like the Trade Accelerator that's helping companies activate export strategies, are now being transferred across to these other large centers. So they'll all benefit from this as well. We're also in discussions with our provincial government about expanding our programming to smaller jurisdictions throughout our province. So there's no exclusivity on growth by city. It really is about piloting things, because we've got the concentration of businesses here, and what's working, we are happy to export across our country.
That's Janet DeSilva, who's the president and CEO of the Toronto Region Board of Trade, speaking to Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan. Now, Moscow recently celebrated its 870th anniversary. It didn't skimp on the festivities, spending 10 million euros on celebrations, culminating in Moscow City Day. Well, this week in Tall Stories, the weekly feature from the team behind The Urbanist, Monocle's Alexei Kolyov took a closer look at those celebrations. ¶¶
I remember the day like it was yesterday. September 1997, Saturday, my first real day out. This was Moscow's 850th birthday. Big day. The celebrations were suitably flamboyant, with Luciano Pavarotti singing in Red Square and Jean-Michel Jarre doing a laser show at the Moscow University. This was the high point of Moscow's newfound post-Soviet prosperity.
Вперед! Сделав еще один шаг к тому, чтобы Москва стала прекрасным, уютным.
Much of it was thanks to its long-serving former mayor, Yuri Lushkov, a powerful and deeply corrupt figure who had very, very bad taste to boot. He even had an entire architectural style named after him, the garish Lushkov style, which changed Moscow's cityscape beyond recognition. But perhaps much more lasting is the effect he had on Muscovites themselves. A populist to the core, Lushkov established a busy annual calendar of public events, with City Day as the centerpiece, and it kind of got Muscovites hooked. So when in 2010 Lushkov was sacked and replaced with Vladimir Putin's protege, Sergei Sobyanin, the new administration had to oblige. And that they did.
Добрый вечер, москвичи! Добрый вечер, друзья!
In fact, under Sobyanin, pomp and ceremony have been taken to a whole new level. This year, as Moscow turns 870, City Hall pulled out all the stops. It even hired some good designers and PR people, uncharacteristically. Sobyanin knows he's got to outdo Lushkov if he really wants Muscovites to like him. And with all the media coverage and publicity and the amount of money he receives from the Kremlin, he stands a good chance. Except it doesn't really matter. City Day has long since become an institution. It's usually held during the last of the warm weather, it marks the beginning of a new school year, it doesn't need any extra frills. What it needs is commitment, a sincere wish to make the city better. And so far, neither Lushkov nor Sobyanin have shown this commitment. A city only works when City Hall wants to get to know its citizens, and City Day is the perfect opportunity for that. But in Moscow, City Hall and citizens are separated, and no amount of pageantry can change that. For Monaco in Moscow, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Fairly dramatic end to the celebrations of Moscow's City Day, as reported by Alexei Korolev there. And you can hear the full edition of The Urbanist at 1900 London time tomorrow here on Monocle 24. Anytime after that via monocle.com or the Monocle 24 app. Well, in just a moment on The Daily, we'll take a look at some of the big stories across Asia.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
What is Culture with Robert Bound?
This is the show of shows.
There was something really magical about it.
Everybody's boozing, having grand adulterous love affairs. There's fabulous fist fights, and everybody is smoking opium.
How did that get in there? Well, when we're not enjoying the after party, we're on an intrepid investigation each week to answer questions like how do you adapt a novel and how do you start an art collection? Culture with Robert Bound is your one-stop shop for the answers to the cultural questions that leave you scratching your head every day. Grab a drink, pull up a chair and tune in every Monday at 1900 London time.
Well, let's take a look now at some of the stories that are making headlines across Asia. My guest in the studio is Michael Buehler, who's from the Department of Politics and International Studies at SOAS, the University of London. Michael, thank you very much for coming in this evening. Let's begin in Vietnam with a Chinese construction project that's run into trouble.
Yeah, so China has been engaging in so-called infrastructure diplomacy for a couple of years now. They basically finance major infrastructure projects across Southeast Asia. The article here from the Nikkei Asian Review talks about how a lot of these projects in Vietnam have run into difficulties. So the work apparently is not as good as it should be. And the planning also has not really been coordinated with a lot of local authorities, which has led to increased congestion, for instance, in Hanoi, which has frustrated the local population.
And of course, the problem with this is that obviously it's a good earner for China on the one hand to be involved in these projects, but it's also supposed to be about expanding its influence and it's enhancing its reputation in the region. It doesn't particularly do that if it then develops a reputation for shoddy workmanship.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, the article here mentions that a couple of projects actually have now been given to local contractors because the reputation of Chinese projects is not so good. And of course, a lot of countries in Southeast Asia take note of the developments here in Vietnam. For instance, Indonesia has major infrastructure projects coming up financed by the Chinese. And of course, they don't want to run into the same kind of difficulties.
And you would assume that this is something in Beijing that they'd be particularly concerned about.
Yeah, but it doesn't seem to be the case. The article mentions here that there are a couple of $100 million actually missing in a kind of a prestige project that the Chinese government has financed in Hanoi, an elevated train track. And so if they can't get it together there, then one wonders how these things look like in the provinces.
It's interesting when China is also looking, obviously, at expanding those sort of projects in other parts of the world. Certainly in the UK, there's been talk about the Chinese building big nuclear power plants.
Certainly, yeah. What's interesting as well is that in Southeast Asia, of course, we have procurement laws as well that very often actually forces local governments to go with the lowest bidder. And very often the Chinese have basically done exactly that. They have submitted very low bids for public infrastructure projects, then have been awarded these kind of projects. And then once they're actually doing them, suddenly they have cost overruns that are sometimes twice as much as the actual project was projected to cost.
Well, another story involving China. China now the source of a significant amount of the money that's being invested in the U.S. property market, but for a slightly interesting reason.
Yeah, so the South China Morning Post reports on basically Chinese parents now buying up property in the United States. Apparently, the Chinese have become the largest foreign property buyer in the United States. Most of them, apparently, parents whose children are in the U.S. studying towards a degree or will study towards a degree in the U.S., and that's a way to finance the exorbitant tuition fees in the United States.
Now, this is interesting for a number of reasons. Firstly, wasn't the Chinese government supposed to be clamping down on foreign property investment?
Yeah, precisely. I mean, the article actually mentions that to prevent capital flight, the Chinese government basically tried to put some brakes on these kind of developments, but apparently it has had not much of an effect. So last year alone, as the article mentions here, Chinese have spent almost 32 billion US dollars in real estate in the United States.
And this isn't that new, and in some ways, globally, this isn't that new. I certainly remember quite a few people who seemed to live in remarkably well-appointed homes when they were students, and it turned out it was because their parents had bought them, A, so that they weren't having to spend money on their child's rent, and B, because it was an investment that they could make money out of. So
yeah.
It's a Western money-making scheme, as it were, that spread to China.
Oh, absolutely. I think what has changed is mainly the source of these kind of investments. I think a couple of years ago, it was probably the Middle East, and right now it has shifted to Asia. And so lots of people from China, but then interestingly from Taiwan as well, and increasingly from South Korea, that are investing in these areas in the United States where you have these Ivy League schools as well. The article, of course, then mentions as well how property prices have exploded in these areas precisely because you have foreign investors that buy up property.
And of course, it's a similar thing that you hear in London, that it's almost impossible for people in London to afford homes because they're being bought up by speculators outside the country.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, about 10 minutes from here, right? The whole Battersea development is basically done by an Asian investor, if I'm not mistaken, I think a Malaysian investor.
Let's move on to Indonesia now, where the talk of a possible fairly significant German investment.
So this is an interesting story reported in the Jakarta Post. So this has been going on for a couple of years now, actually. We have a large gold mine in Indonesia, the Freeport gold mine, which has now been forced by the government to give up its majority of shares to local state-owned companies if they want to have their contract, their mining contract renewed. And so what this article now talks about is that a lot of these state-owned enterprises do not have enough money to actually buy up these shares that now are basically freed up and are available on the market. And so apparently Deutsche Bank has now approached the Indonesian government and offered its help to basically finance these deals. For me, that was an interesting story because, of course, there's all sorts of problems here in the future with regard to these kind of shareholder arrangements. You can already imagine how in a country where corruption is systemic and endemic, when you suddenly have now, instead of a single majority shareholder, you have dozens of shareholders that try to make as much money as they can from these mining activities, what kind of governance issues that will bring up. And so I was quite surprised to see that Deutsche Bank has actually willing to finance this mess.
And the reputational risk there.
Absolutely.
6 years from now, we discover that there have been backhanders flying left, right and center.
Oh, absolutely. And the person here involved, Maritime Affairs Minister Luhut Panjaitan, someone who has been involved in the mining business for a very long time. He actually now owns a company as well that's investing in the extractive industry. And so, of course, a rent-seeking enterprise of major proportions that has been ongoing in Indonesia for a couple of years now. And you may remember that the Rothschild Bank a couple of years ago has run into trouble in Indonesia trying to finance some of these deals. And so they seem to have learned not much given now that the Deutsche Bank is trying to get into this market.
Finally, why is Phnom Penh being described as a city of garbage?
So the last article I brought is from the Southeast Asia Globe, which basically talks about the waste problem that Phnom Penh is facing. There's apparently a single a company that has a monopoly on garbage collection, and they just seem to profit from that. So they basically have no incentives to change anything in terms of how they collect the garbage. The system doesn't work, but because they're their sole agent to do so, they can pretty much do whatever they want, it says here.
I suppose I'm trying to think of places where you have a choice of who collects your garbage, because most in London, the city of Westminster drives around all the streets around our building, and I can't ring up and say I'm not happy with the way these guys are dealing with my rubbish. I'd like someone to come in from Haringey or something.
Right. Well, I don't know here whether then it's just done under the brand of the City of Westminster and whether they actually contracted out to subcontractors that are going through a competitive process. In many other countries, however, garbage collection is part of the local procurement office, and they basically write out these contracts once a year, and then people bid for it or companies bid for it. Now, apparently here in Cambodia, there's a single company interestingly, actually managed by Canadians, that basically has been in charge of garbage collection for a couple of years now. And as the article describes here, they have basically not been very good at it. Part of it has to do with the fact that Phnom Penh has just seen an influx of poor rural citizens. And so the city has expanded quite dramatically. And so this may just be a case where this company is just simply overwhelmed with the urban explosion that we have seen, the population explosion in urban areas in Phnom Penh.
I suppose we've come full circle in a way, because we started talking about the Chinese companies that were undercutting all the local contractors to get those big development contracts that they then couldn't fulfill properly. And now we're back at undercutting garbage collection.
Yeah, well, there's not even any competition right now in Phnom Penh, which makes this an interesting case. Yeah.
Michael, we'll have to leave it there, but thank you very much for coming in this evening. Michael Pula from SOAS here in London. You're listening to The Daily from Monocle 24. Now, finally, on tonight's Monocle Daily, London is currently hosting its 15th design festival, attracting talent from around the world. Among them, Ineke Hans, the Dutch industrial designer, who's showcasing her collaboration with the Fogo Island Inn, which is a hotel in Newfoundland and Canada. Well, earlier, she spoke to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
This is a project that is now part of the shop, but it came about like a few years ago where Zita Kopp, the founder of Shorefast Foundation, started a project with an inn on a very remote island in the north of Canada between Newfoundland and Greenland, which is an extremely cold island. People are leaving there because it's a rural community, and like very often, these communities turn grey. There's not so much to do. The fishermen that used to work there have less to do because the big trailers came and the fish got smaller. She was a businesswoman before, and she gave that up and started projects to get little businesses and entrepreneurships to that island. And she started to build also an inn. And for that, she invited all kind of designers to design the furniture. And she asked me specifically to design wooden furniture for the inn. So I did a long bench, I did a rocker, I did a wooden chair. And I had to work with the people from the islands. So the men who used to build boats in the winter when they were not fishing were now turning into woodworkers who made the furniture. And the women would do some of the upholstery on it, and they would be usually meeting every Tuesday evening in one of the old churches to do crochet, quilt making and so on, and giggle and do all kind of gossip, of course. So this was the setting that this project started for the inn. And because it was supposed to be a project for a longer term, They started to sell the furniture in Canada, so that these guys have still something to do, when the inn is finished. And now they're trying to bring it over to Europe, which is presented now at London Design Festival in Brompton Design District. And the nice thing is also that they present it now with nutrition labels, which are like, how much exactly is going where? Where is your money going? How much is going into labor? How much is going into selling? How much is going to the designer? It tries to show a kind of different perspective to design by working with designers in another way, but also by doing these nutrition labels.
That's amazing. How would you describe this, you know, the style, the architecture of Fogo Island? And did you have to think out with, you know, with this in mind when you did your pieces?
Well, we visited Fogo Island first, and then I looked at the pieces that they had from the past. And the nice thing about that, the people basically have ancestors very often from Ireland. But when they came from Ireland, these first people, they didn't have machines or woodworking stuff and so on, but they had to make some furniture. So what they did is they made furniture that reminded them of home. So it became a kind of fantasy furniture, which I really liked. It was very tough, and at home they had some wood spinnings in the backs of the seats, but here they couldn't do that. So some table legs of that time, you see that they started to cut it, which was a bit childish and a bit naive, but really lovely and far too chunky. And it fits to that island because it's a rough environment. It's 35 degrees below zero in the winter. So I took that, these kind of spinnings, as a starting point for my benches and my seats, but made very bold and splitted them in half. So they become half flat sides for the back of the seats and would become more comfortable. One of the things that I also thought was be nice is because these, especially the guys, they used to be the boss on the boat and anarchists. I thought, you know, it would be very difficult for them to listen to a woman. And so I thought, I give them a couple of sizes at this benches at the back, at the bottom and at the top. And in between, they can fantasize whatever they like to do so that they could have some freedom themselves. And in the end, they made everything the same. They got a copier machine because they thought we want to do industrial production. And I think that's fine that it turned out to be that way. But it was quite funny to see that.
And like, as I said in the beginning of the interview, your room are full of projects here at the London Design Festival. I would like to talk a little bit about the Salon, which is one of your projects. Tell us a bit more and how can we see that at the Design Festival?
Yes. Now, yeah, the Salons came up as a project. I moved back to London 2 years ago. I used to live here before. And when I had a studio in Holland, I was seeing things happening and changing in furniture design. There's a lot of things in society that affect furniture design at the moment. We're going to live in smaller spaces and more expensive spaces, which means that we have less money and less space for furniture. The contract in the domestic market for furniture has changed completely a lot, and it becomes much more domestic at your workplace. The fact that we are ordering online, gazing at furniture online, and want to have it delivered to our home means that designers have to design three-piece sofas that can go to your letterbox. So it means there's a lot of things changing. There's a young generation that is not interested in possession. And I wanted to do something with that. So when I came here, I organized salons in East London studios with everyone from the design, from the furniture field, designers, curators, manufacturers, retailers, and all sat around a table to discuss what would be the future for furniture design and consequently the changing position of the designer. And with that, I made now a wrap-up of all these 12 salons that I organized. And it's a kind of exhibition that shows recommendations conclusions and says this is what we could do, and it shows also a couple of examples of what that could mean. So it's not so much about it's called Explore and Act, so it's meant to also give a kind of hint to where can we act now.
That's fascinating. I think everyone in the design community would be interested to hear, you know, about these changes that are happening. And yeah, very, very interesting indeed. And finally, Nek, I just want to talk about your project from Malawi.
Yeah, it's a similar project then as the project on Fogo. With my studio, I work a lot on very industrial projects, like with injection molding and things like that. But these projects like Fogo and Malawi are slightly different because it's a completely different setup in the project. It's also different in what you get back from it as a designer. And the project in Malawi is with farmers from Malawi that have a job. So it's not that we are helping pitiful people, but they have crafts, traditions, and they know have skills that my grandmother used to have and I don't have anymore, or my parents used to have. And they use that and they can do fantastic weaving. And they keep that alive by doing as a side job the weaving of objects. And I did a project called Storage and Stools, which are baskets and nice little stools.
That is Ineke Hans talking to Monocle's Fernando Augusta Pacheco. You can find out more about her work at the festival on her website, which is inekehans.com. And that is it for this edition of the Monocle Daily, produced by Henry Rhys Sheridan. Our researchers are Daphne Canizis and Maddie Speed. Our studio manager, Claire Urban. The Globalist here, 8 hours from now, with Georgina Godwin sitting in this chair. The Monocle Daily returns at 2200 London time tomorrow. For the moment, from me, Paul Oswald, and everyone on the programme, thanks very much for listening. Goodbye for now. We will leave you with the Manic Street Preachers. This is 90s indie classic, A Design for Life. Life risking.